from WNYC in New York. This is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When Congress passed President Obama's economic recovery package, $7 billion were set aside to help bridge what is often called the digital divide. As some put it at the time, a chicken in every pot, a car in every garage, and a broadband connection in every home. This week, Vice President Joe Biden announced where some of that money is going.
Today, it's nearly $200 million in grants and loans we're going to announce. And when it's all said and done, we'll be awarding $7.2 billion for access to broadband in areas like Dawsonville and all around the country.
But some say that money is just a drop in an Olympic-sized bucket. That America, like Finland, like South Korea, like Canada, Japan, France, and many others, should formulate an ambitious national broadband policy to tackle the issue. Well, in just a couple of months, the Federal Communications Commission, after much fact-finding and town hall meetings, will introduce that long-awaited plan. Ben Scott is policy director for Free Press, an organization that has lobbied for better broadband access in Washington, D.C.
We've taken a path for broadband competition different than any other nation in the world.
How far behind these other countries are we, really? Can you compare and contrast Canadian broadband policy with American policy and Canadian broadband access with American access?
The main difference between the Canadian broadband market and ours is competition. We have for many years been stuck in what economists call a duopoly, two choices, the cable company and the phone company. There are laws in Canada, as there are in virtually every other developed nation, that require the local telephone companies to share their networks with competitors. So if you remember back in the dark ages when we were all using dial-up internet, you could choose between NetZero or AOL or Bob's ISP there in your town. That was because in those days we had the same laws. You had lots of different companies competing for your business over the same wire into your house. But several years ago, we decided to gut those laws. We took them off the books in 2005.
So let's start with the announcement by Biden this week, which attaches names and places to the abstract idea of a digital divide. Could you talk about a couple of the programs that are slated to get stimulus money and how they'll tackle the divide?
Well, two major digital divides exist in this country. One is about geography, and the other is about income. So let's take geography first. They've gone down to northern Georgia, which, as you might imagine, is a pretty rural area, and they've found a whole bunch of different small towns, lots of farming communities, that don't have high-speed internet access. So what they've done is they've given a grant of some $180 million so that the northern Georgia network can build a 260-mile fiber optic ring, a loop of cable that's in the ground and strung from telephone poles that will connect all of these little farming communities one to another so that all of the households, tens of thousands, can get access to the same kinds of high-speed internet products that are available in big cities like Washington and New York.
What about the income digital divide?
Another really important grant they're making is up in Boston, the city with a great deal of economic inequality. So what this grant is intended to do is give money to schools and libraries, community centers, and public housing projects to put computing centers in all of these places, dozens of places scattered around the city, so that kids can come home after school and go to the computing center if they don't have internet access at home, and there they'll find a high-speed connection, and they'll find technology training if they don't know how to use computers yet.
Now, there are some people that you will be surprised to know, still argue that high-speed internet, unlike, say, heat or electricity, just isn't a necessity in times of national economic hardship. You disagree with that. You say we've reached an indisputable tipping point.
The tipping point was the Recovery Act. In that bill and in the debate about it, they talked about broadband as a fundamental infrastructure, just like electricity or water or roads. And there is this debate. Does broadband really belong in that category? And shouldn't we be treating it still as an entertainment service? And if you look back through the 20th century, over the last 100 years of history, what you see is every time a new technology came along that later became a fundamental infrastructure that no one would disagree is necessary for universal access, there was this debate. Do people really need to have flush toilets in their house? I can make do with an outhouse. Do we really need to have electricity? Farmers in Iowa, they like their candles. Why would anyone want to have a telephone in their house? Then people can bother you in the evenings.
I kind of feel that way.
Yeah, perhaps we should revisit that history. Each of these moments, and they're generational moments, we can see a dispute as people push and pull about whether or not something is going to become a piece of our essential infrastructure. I think indisputably we've moved into that category with internet access.
I'm just concerned about, have I played devil's advocate enough here? Is there any argument I can make against this? I can't come up with one.
Well, the strong arguments against it are, you know, if you're talking about an aggressive competition policy, you're talking about tackling the cable and telecom industries at a time when corporate America has dominance over public policy. There's a certain question of political viability to some of these policy changes that we would advocate. Second is, you know, there's no money and we're in huge debt. And if we're talking about the national broadband infrastructure, boy, that's going to be tens of billions of dollars over the course of the next decade. People could rightly be concerned that we need to exercise fiscal discipline and that's not a necessity. I think that's incorrect and that ultimately investment in broadband yields so much back in terms of economic growth that it's worth it 10 times over. But that's a debate we're going to have in the Congress and in main streets across the country.
Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ben Scott is Policy Director for Free Press, a communications advocacy group in Washington, D.C.
On Monday, the Supreme Court announced it will hear a case about whether an Ontario, California police department violated the constitutional privacy rights of one of its cops when it reviewed personal text messages he had sent on a government pager. The case is the first the Supreme Court has taken that has to do with the Fourth Amendment privacy protection of an employee's text messages. It comes at a time when technology has blurred lines between work and private life, and when the same technology gives employers access to every keystroke on company hardware. David Savage, who's been following the case for the Los Angeles Times, joins me now. David, welcome to OTM.
Hi, Bob.
So the case involved a police officer who had been using his department-issued pager to send kind of a salacious text messages, correct?
Yes, to a girlfriend who also worked for the police department. The city had a policy saying that our computers and cell phones are for business use and you should have no right to privacy. However, after these pagers were distributed, one of the lieutenants who was in charge of this, Sergeant Kwan and several others, said, look, you guys can use these, but if you go over the 25,000 characters a month in the text that's in the contract, you have to pay for it. And so their understanding was that they could use this for personal messages as well as business messages, and that's what Sergeant Kwan did.
Let's talk about the appeals court decision that the Supreme Court is reviewing. They looked at the particulars and found that, yes, the police department overreached. Was that a decision without precedent in the federal courts?
I don't know of another decision like this from a federal appeals court. I should say, Bob, that one of the most important concepts in the Fourth Amendment is what judges call a reasonable expectation of privacy. Way back in the 60s, the court had a case involving a fellow who was a gambler who was making phone calls at a payphone in Los Angeles. And the Supreme Court in that case said that even though he wasn't in his own house, the government couldn't wiretap him because when he was standing in a glass phone booth, he had a reasonable expectation that his calls were private. And that concept has continued all along. And so when a court gets a case like this, the question is, did this person have a reasonable expectation of privacy? And what was unusual in this case was that the Ninth Circuit looked at this case closely and said, yes, these employees had been led to believe that they could use these pagers and send text messages and that they were personal and that therefore looking through the contents of the messages amounted to an unreasonable search.
The fact that this is a government agency involved, I think, clouds the issue that's of interest to most of our listeners, and that is the degree to which a private employer is permitted to snoop on its employees via the electronic gizmos, whether it's pagers or cell phones or computers, that they issue. I think we are all of us very exposed. And what I want to know is, no matter what the Supreme Court may rule here, whether it will provide any clarity for civilians of civilian employers.
I think it will provide some clarity and some guidance, and I'll tell you why. Because if you talk to lawyers, they all say, on the one hand, the Fourth Amendment decisions grow out of the government. But most judges around the country, their privacy rulings are guided very much by what the Supreme Court says about the constitutional law. So these cases can come up in a lot of different ways. You can work for a private company and still file some sort of invasion of privacy suit in a situation like this. And when judges then look to say, okay, what's a reasonable expectation of privacy, they're very much guided by the Supreme Court's decisions in the Fourth Amendment area. So technically, this is a case about government employees, but practically speaking, down the road, I think the decision will affect private companies as well.
Obviously, employers have some interest in what's going on their networks and on their hardware. On the other hand, if I'm using an office computer to tell somebody about my cancer, for example, whether I want my employer to know that and whether they have any right to see it, because after all, they may find me an unacceptable healthcare risk. In fact, I'm not sure that I want my boss to know what I'm having for dinner tonight. Will this case clarify that conflict?
I think it will, but I think it's just a start. I think the Supreme Court's rulings will set sort of a general picture of the Fourth Amendment law. And then I think there'll be a whole series of cases in the lower courts, the state courts, different iterations of privacy. And always the question will be, did the employee have a reason to believe that his messages, his texts were private and personal?
Now, there's another legal wrinkle in this case, because while the Supreme Court agreed to hear the privacy question, it let stand the appeals court ruling concerning the Electronic Communications Privacy Act of 1986 that prohibits a wireless service provider from revealing the substance of electronic messages without the consent of either the sender or the recipient.
Yes, this is a victory for employees already, a privacy victory, because by letting that decision stand, it basically says that the law is that if you're a wireless service provider and you've got stored messages from somebody, you can't turn them over to the employer without the consent of the person who sent them or the person who received them. I think the possibility is the Supreme Court thought that that's what the law says, and so that's what it means. So they chose not to review or reconsider that decision, but leaving it stand is actually a fairly big deal.
All right, David. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
David Savage covers the Supreme Court for the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times.
Coming up, recovering documents to fill in history.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In an Associated Press MTV poll released this month, a quarter of the teenage respondents said they'd been, quote, involved in sexting in some way. Beginning late last year, some prosecutors made headlines when they enforced child pornography laws against kids who had texted or emailed naked photographs of themselves. The prosecutors argued that taking a nude self-portrait is a crime if you're a minor. Since then, law enforcement seems mostly to have dropped that argument, but no one else has come up with a way to defuse this combustible combination of adolescent psychology and technology. Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon has been writing about the issue. She joins me. Emily, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with Hope Witzel, please. Tell me about her story.
Hope Witzel was 13. She grew up in a Florida suburb, and in September, she hung herself with a pink scarf in her bedroom. This was a few months after sending out a photograph of her breasts to a boy at school, a photograph that someone forwarded to a bunch of other teenagers at her school. This is a middle school, and which then led to her being tormented in the hallways and to writing very mournfully about the name she was being called. And so it seems like there is a real link here between this act of sexting and this girl's tragic suicide.
And the reason we're talking about Hope is because, as horrifying as this tragedy is, it's not necessarily unique. Kids tend to immediately pass these images on to their friends, and then all hell breaks loose.
Right. It seems incredibly rash and stupid to send a naked picture of yourself over a cell phone, but you're sending it originally to someone you trust. This is a friend or a guy you like. It's not someone you're expecting to be betrayed by. But the problem is that once these pictures are in existence, it's all too easy for them to get forwarded on. And then they become fodder for gossip and the kind of salacious scandal that we all are kind of addicted to, and teenagers perhaps most of all.
There is a tendency to look at the technology and focus there and say that this is somehow at fault. We have to harness this technology somehow. How are authorities dealing with this?
When we started talking about this about a year ago, it seemed like prosecutors were thinking of cracking down on the kids who were sending the photos. Now there seems to be a pulling back from that and a realization that we passed these child porn statutes to protect kids, so it doesn't really make sense to use them to go after children. A couple of states have already downgraded their laws about child porn so that they aren't punishing sexting in the same way. But that leaves open the question of how we are supposed to address this. Technology becomes this kind of diabolically perfect vehicle for bullying, which obviously is like a traditional thing that's always happened. Kids have always found ways to be mean to each other. But now there's a way to be mean simply by touching a button. And so the tormentor is removed from the person he or she is hurting.
One final thought. I saw some reporting done by the Today Show about the Hope Witzel story. And the kids who went to her middle school are obviously mortified, and they seem to have been scared straight. Is there anybody who's going into schools with Hope Witzel stories or stories like that and doing on the subject of cyberbullying what we've seen with drunk driving and drug use and various other social ills over the years?
I think that is just starting to happen. There is a group called the Cyberbullying Research Center in Florida. It's run by two academics named Samir Handuja and Justin Patchen. And I was talking to them last week. They go around talking to kids and educators in different parts of the country. And they said that they have been using for a long time the story of Megan Meyer, the Missouri teenager who committed suicide after cyberbullying by the mother of a friend of hers. And now that they would be adding the story of Hope Witzel to the sessions they do in an effort to make kids sit up and pay attention to the consequences of these kinds of acts.
Emily, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Bazelon writes about law for Slate.
Initially, the Bush administration said they were gone. Tens of millions of emails lost forever. The reason? Inadequate digital record keeping in the White House. This despite two federal laws requiring that White House communications be preserved for the public record. And so, in 2007, after a congressional request was ignored, two open government groups, the National Security Archive, or NSA, and Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, filed a joint lawsuit demanding the emails be recovered. And this week, they won. Some 22 million emails have been recovered so far, though many more may have been lost for good. Ann Weissman is chief counsel for CREW. Ann, welcome back to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So start with the bad news. How long until we know exactly what's in those emails?
Oh, it's probably 5 to 12 years, depending. Most of them are probably covered by the Presidential Records Act. This law that says that they're not available for at least 5 years after the president leaves office, and the president can actually designate for certain reasons an additional 7 years during which the public cannot get access to his records.
How were they found?
Every system has a backup tape system in place that's there in case of a system crash. What we didn't know and what we still don't know is just how complete those backup tapes are. What's gone is gone. If it's not on a backup tape, we have no other way of getting it.
The Bush administration often used outside email addresses, possibly to evade the records preservation dragnet, and the president didn't use email at all. But you don't think the emails were lost on purpose, do you?
We don't know exactly what happened. There is evidence that White House staff knowingly used outside email accounts. And we know that the president, by and large, did not use email. But we just don't know enough here about what happened and why. I mean, we know that just from a technical standpoint, they weren't using the right system. It didn't have the right controls in it. And that alone could account for why the emails are missing. Eventually, we'd like to get the whole story, but I think that's highly unlikely.
What do you think is in there that we need to know, or is it the principle that's at stake here?
It's both. I mean, certainly the principle is very important. It's a principle of accountability. But I think there is a chance that these particular records could prove to be very valuable. They cover some really critical events of the Bush administration. They cover to what extent the vice president and his staff were involved in the disclosure of Valerie Plame Wilson's covert CIA identity. the whole scandal over the firing of the U.S. attorneys and the White House's role in that. They cover the buildup to war, and we are hopeful that some of what's being restored will shed some light on that.
Are you satisfied that there are procedures in place or procedures being implemented so that this doesn't happen again?
Yes. Our lawsuit has really had three components, and the settlement that we reached with the Obama administration addresses all three. We were interested in restoring as many of the missing emails as possible. We were interested in getting records that would give us some explanation of what happened and perhaps why, and we are getting that. And the third thing we wanted was assurances that the White House now has an appropriate system in place. They have been willing to share with us documents that they do have such a system in place, and they are now in the process of preparing for public disclosure that will let the public also see how and why it is that they are now in compliance with their obligations. We do not face the same risk today that we did a number of years ago of losing a lot of our nation's history.
Anne, thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Anne Weissman is chief counsel for the advocacy group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington.
Newly published declassified documents from long ago fill in another piece of history. In Argentina's so-called dirty war of the late 1970s and early 80s, between 13 and 30,000 people were disappeared by the ruling military regime. Journalist Jacobo Timmerman was one of them. A popular reporter, he founded the daily newspaper La Opinión in 1971. Under his leadership, the paper focused on the dictatorship's human rights violations. On April 15, 1977, he was arrested, accused of subversion, and subjected to beatings, electric shock torture, and solitary confinement, all of which he later chronicled in the book, Prisoner Without a Name, Cell Without a Number. Timmerman became a poster child for the repression of the regime, which came under great pressure from the world, especially the United States, until he was finally released and exiled 30 months later. After democracy returned to Argentina in 1983, Timmerman moved back to Buenos Aires and lived there until his death in 1999. Peter Kornbluh, a senior analyst with the National Security Archive, says declassified documents published by his organization earlier this month give new insight into the Timmerman case.
The documents confirm the Argentine military regime almost fractured due to the international pressure to release Timmerman. The titular head of the junta, General Videla, threatened to resign, as did the entire Supreme Court, if the military high command did not actually agree to release Timmerman. And the documents show that the high command voted 6-3 to keep him prisoner, even after the Supreme Court for the second time had ruled that there was absolutely no reason to hold him.
Those in the regime who were insisting that the military release Timmerman weren't exactly bleeding hearts.
We're not really talking about a great range on the political spectrum here in Argentina. This was a military junta. The head of the junta, General Videla, came under direct pressure. President Carter talked to him about the Timmerman case. Vice President Mondale talked to him about the Timmerman case. And our U.S. ambassador talked to him repeatedly about the Timmerman case. And he received all the pressures from around the world as well. Basically, he came to the conclusion that even the military regime would be better served if Timmerman was released. But there are other hardliners in the high command who felt that he should be held as a subversive.
Do we have any reason to believe that alleged subversion was what the kidnapping and torture were really all about?
Really, the declassified record shows that the Argentine military had it in for Jacobo Timmerman for years. And those documents go all the way back to the 50s, and they show that the Argentine intelligence was tracking Jacobo Timmerman as a journalist during his entire journalistic career, and that as early as 1959, they were putting out internal reports on him, which had language like this, es considerado un judío muy peligroso, which translates, he is considered a dangerous Jew. And the anti-Semitism of the Argentine military clearly was a major factor in spying on him, arresting him in April of 1977, brutally torturing him for over a year, and then keeping him under house arrest for more than a year after that.
Now, this was a case that had essentially the direct intervention of an American president, Jimmy Carter. At the time, was the administration's participation fully public?
Well, it wasn't fully public. Carter actually spoke directly with Videla after Timmerman was arrested in 1977, when Videla came to the signing of the Panama Canal treaties and asked that Timmerman be released. One of the documents we posted is a meeting that Timmerman had with our Assistant Secretary for Human Rights, Patricia Darien, just 2.5 weeks before he was arrested. And I think that that document actually gives you a sense that one of the things that angered the generals in Argentina was the fact that he was meeting with U.S. officials who were now under the Carter administration, speaking up very clearly about human rights atrocities in Argentina.
I must say, Peter, it was kind of refreshing looking at the traffic that these documents revealed because, you know, only a few years earlier, and in fact also only a few years later, U.S. participation in places in Latin America had a much more sinister cast.
Carter ran as a human rights president to repudiate the Nixon and Ford administration's embrace of not only the junta in Argentina, but the Pinochet regime in Chile. After Carter lost his election to Ronald Reagan, you'll recall, Reagan decided that he would go with what he called quiet diplomacy, which in many people's minds was equal to no diplomacy on human rights, and cozied up to the military regimes in the Southern Cone. So, yes, the record of the Carter period is an important one on human rights, and these documents on the Timmerman case shed further light on the more active efforts of the White House during the Carter era to get political prisoners like Timmerman and others released from torturers in Chile and Argentina and Paraguay and Uruguay and elsewhere.
One for the good guys.
One for the good guys.
Peter, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be with you one more time.
Peter Kornbluh is a senior analyst for the National Security Archive, a nonpartisan nonprofit documentation center in Washington, D.C. Timmerman had three sons. One of them, Hector, is a journalist, human rights activist, and now the Argentine ambassador to the United States. He says the recently released documents reaffirm the brutality of the military regime during the Dirty War.
I don't want to use a common phrase, but this is the banality of evil. All the information is gossip, nothing. Small talk among different spying organizations. But what it is very sad about all this is that many people in Argentina died because of those reports. That, for instance, in the case of my father, he was called a dangerous communist. Then he was called 2 years later a communist, but not so dangerous. All the time he's being called a Jew. No, a Jewish communist, a Jewish this, a Jewish that. It is really worth reading to see that Hannah Arendt was right, absolutely right.
The banality of evil. Looking at these documents that have emerged, what has crystallized about that period that perhaps had never crystallized before?
Well, something that I have learned, not now, but during the dictatorship, is that the defense of democracy and democratic values in general have to be above anything else. I was a revolutionary when I was a young person. I didn't have any concern about democratic values. But now I think that everything has to be done with a respect for democracy and democratic institutions.
With the release of this documentation, both from the secret police of Argentina and the U.S. State Department, how has it been covered in the Argentine press, and how has the public reacted?
His case was so well known that nobody really gets impressed by what the newspapers are publishing these days. It's not like the same thing when you find out somebody who was missing and they found their bones or they found what happened 30 years ago with them, no?
So these documents, are you saying it's like unearthing a grave of bones and we've long since known what happened to the disappeared, but yeah, here are the bones, but of course.
What I'm saying is that many times I have to pursue my father's case because it's a good way to bring attention to other people's fate who are not so well known, especially, for instance, the kids that were born 30 years ago in the illegal and the clandestine jails. You know that we have 400 kids that were born in captivity that we are still looking for them. We don't know where they are. the children of political prisoners who were born in captivity.
In some cases, actually, have been adopted by their captors.
Yeah, well, they are kept by their captors. The problem is that we don't have too much information, and they are not eager to give information. They should know who their real parents are. But anyway, going back about that, my father is a very well-known and very well-regarded person by his colleagues and by the public in general. So the figure of my father brings me a lot of happiness. I am very proud of what he did, the way he did it. He stand up for his values. He paid the price, but he showed that it is worth sometimes paying that price. And so if I keep my father's memory, it's not only just to pay honor to my father, but to use his well-known case in order to bring attention to the people who were forgotten in Argentina.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Hector Timmerman is the Argentine ambassador to the United States.
Coming up, can we control our own personal histories?
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Many have observed that time contracts in cyberspace, but it can feel like it also expands indefinitely, especially when it comes to a piece of personal information we'd sooner forget. Should people pay for a cyber mistake forever? How do media outlets respond when someone wants to amend the record and change their personal history? On the Media's Nazanin Rafsanjani explores the issue, beginning with an unusual funeral that will perhaps become more usual in the years to come.
Friends and family are gathered here today at a funeral to bid farewell and pay their respects to the memory of a young man they've known for years. But at this funeral, the dearly departed greets them at the door.
Hello, welcome to my funeral.
Hi.
This is not a funeral for a person. It's for a name. 3 years ago, a college senior wrote a story for his school newspaper, the Harvard Crimson. The topic was a bit risque. The piece was about
my use of Craigslist to look for sex with closeted Harvard jocks. It was a big hit. It's my number one Google result, of course. But now, you know, 3 years later, I find that I'd really like to be an elementary school teacher. So I'm really wary of the possibility of, you know, a 10-year-old kid coming across this because, you know, if I were like in fourth grade, I'd be Googling my teachers all the time. It's really nothing I want coming back to haunt me.
It's a really good funeral, I think.
At first, he tried to outrun his Google hits. He registered a domain name, he did other writing, hoping the piece would at least slip down to the second page of search results. But it wouldn't budge. So now, he's legally changing his name. I'll call him Peter. Peter's 25, and in retrospect, it seems clear that writing a tell-all about using the internet to find anonymous sex may not have been the wisest move. But he was in college, a risk-taking time. Plus, the piece was witty, honest, and discerning. For a writer, it might have been the right thing to do. For a teacher, not so much.
I picture a kid saying, I Googled you last night, and I found a really funny article, or a really weird article. I picture losing my authority in some ways, you know. I feel like I would have made a joke of myself in front of my students. There's parents Googling. I mean, I guess that's another huge fear. And even if I were hired by a school that was really understanding and might take the position of, well, you know, he was in college and things happen, I don't really want to put any of my future employers in that position of having to defend that. I don't want to be a problem or a liability for anyone.
The name funeral is mostly a happy occasion. People are joking about the absurdity of this whole situation.
I think I need to change my Facebook profile name.
I think she needs a brand new one.
But for Peter's mom, it's a goodbye to her son's old name and his identity, at least online.
It really is a very painful thing. He's got nothing to be ashamed of, and somehow he's sort of fleeing from this story. in this world, that's, it just can't compartmentalize your life. And I guess there's part of me that hopes in the years to come that he can reveal his old name again, you know, even if he doesn't go by it anymore, at least it'll be sort of public again.
Peter asked the Harvard Crimson several times if they'd take down the story. They declined. They also declined to talk with us for this story. Peter says they told him that removing his piece would set a dangerous precedent. News organizations grapple with this a lot these days. What to do when an article is haunting someone online. Joshua Benton is the director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard and the faculty advisor for the Crimson. He can't address Peter's case specifically because he wasn't there at the time the decisions were made. But he says nowadays, everything is on the record, youthful missteps and all.
Embarrassment is not a good enough reason for some bit of history to be removed. The idea that someone who knows how to work the system well enough to make the appeal to the right place, that those people would get to control their image, I don't find that very appealing, because there are going to be lots of people who don't know how to work that system, and they're the ones who are going to still have their youthful indiscretions on display forever.
Benton says national newspapers like the New York Times or Washington Post set the example for college papers, and they have pretty strict policies against removing an article from the web. But this problem is so new that news organizations are making up the rules as they go along. Kathy English is the public editor at the Toronto Star. She recently surveyed 110 newspaper editors across North America and found that roughly half had no official policy for a rising number of these requests. English gets one nearly every week. For example, there was a young law student who was briefly arrested.
The charges were dropped before they ever came to court, but the media had reported on it. He came to me saying, could you please remove this story because I'm named here. This is going to affect my chance of getting a job in a law firm. This is going to follow me for the rest of my life. We looked at it. What we did was updated the story with a note that says all charges against him were dropped on such and such a date before it ever came to court. When I told him that we wouldn't take the story down, he wasn't particularly happy with that. He wanted the story to disappear.
She says as compelling as these individual cases can be, a news organization has always had a bigger responsibility to the record.
To the public good. Newspaper archives have always lived on. Because somebody didn't like a story, we didn't go into the library and cut a story off the page and make it disappear. The issue now is it's so easily accessible to everyone.
Dean Betts is the content director at the Houston Chronicle. He remembers exactly one case in which the newspaper removed a story from the web, due essentially to what journalists call source remorse. The person interviewed regretted it years later.
We had done a story some years back about a street junkie, and a reporter spent a lot of time with her and documented many aspects of her life in a very long and complete piece. Some years later, we were contacted by her family saying, look, we want to talk to you about this story. She has gotten clean. She's now has a professional life. And she's worried that this reporting is going to damage her for the rest of her life after having given us access at a time where she was very vulnerable and perhaps wasn't exhibiting the best judgment because of her chemical addiction. And believe me, this is something that came amid hours of discussion and a lot of weighing of the ethical pros and cons before we decided that, yeah, we really should honor this request and try to remove this from the web.
Betts points out that this story was published in the very early days of newspapers online. And that's why they were able to make it go away by removing it from their site. Today, even if he were to agree to take down a story, it wouldn't go away.
With Twitter and aggregation sites and everything else that's out there indexing our content and discussing our content, maybe we could delete it from our site, but it's going to be on the internet forever.
This isn't just about Google, says Gabriel Stricker, head of search communications there. It's also about us. We've come to expect access to anything and everything. All the information available, all the time.
Trust me, it makes things extremely challenging for us to have such high expectations from users. That process of finding a needle in a haystack, every time we do that, people's expectations of what other needles and what other haystacks we can surface, those expectations start becoming greater and greater.
Google was founded in 1998. Peter, the guy who's changing his name, was 14 years old at the time. You could say he's part of a transitional generation, old enough to remember life pre-Google, but young enough to have embraced the internet before the consequences of oversharing were clear to anyone. Those who are 14 now, the so-called digital natives, will never know a world in which Google doesn't open a window onto the past and they may understand better that we have very little control over what lives online. Dean Betts of the Houston Chronicle is quite thankful that his college self isn't following him around today.
Because there were things that we did that were just terrible. It's an unforgiving world right now. And that's one price that we pay for having such access, unrivaled, unimaginable access to information, is that, well, my information is part of that too. Your stuff is not your stuff anymore. You don't own it if it's on the web. It's out there.
Back at the funeral, a friend is delivering the eulogy for Peter's name.
Who among us has not dreamt of starting over, of wiping the slate clean, of artificially absolving ourselves of responsibility for everything we've ever done? May he lead a timid, uneventful life. Marked by no accomplishments that anyone would ever care to document online.
A couple of years ago, Google CEO Eric Schmidt joked that everyone growing up now should change their name when they're 21. But perhaps there will come a point when we'll all have something awkward or even potentially damaging about us on the web. And if it's public for everyone, then maybe we're protected by the crowd. All of us, living out our most embarrassing moments, one Google search at a time, in front of one another. For On the Media, I'm Nazanin Rafsanjani.
Don't name a city.
Scattering bits and pieces of our lives behind us in the moment is a byproduct of the digital age, but meticulously constructing our personal narratives for posterity, that's an ancient tradition. Journalist Ben Yagoda has just authored a book that traces the long and storied life of the memoir. It's called Memoir, A History. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brooke. It's great to be here.
So can anything that we write about that happened to us be called a memoir? Because your book touches on everything from the Confessions of St. Augustine to Dishwasher, one man's quest to wash dishes in all 50 states.
Now, in this memoir boom that's lasted, 15 years or so, memoir is a brand. So sure, The Dishwasher, Julie Powell, a memoir of Julie and Julia. The way I look at it and the way I defined it for the book was a book-length endeavor that purported to tell the story of all or part of the author's life.
So let's start with the saint, the confession. You admire it very much.
Yes, it was a singular book of its kind. It came out in the 3rd century, and here was a man, St. Augustine, much as men and women do today, bearing his soul.
I wish now to review in memory my past wickedness and the carnal corruptions of my soul. Not because I still love them, but that I may love thee, O my God. For love of thy love I do this, recalling in the bitterness of self-examination my wicked ways.
Do you think that St. Augustine embroidered things? You know, lied?
Well, the short answer is yes. The longer answer would discuss what the word lie means. He thought the memory was a perfect instrument or a perfectible instrument. All psychological research ever since has indicated that it is very far from that. So we distort as we remember. Today, when someone writes a memoir, the custom is that you put in pages and pages of dialogue that might have taken place 2 years ago or 40 years ago. That is fiction. I can't remember what I said to you 2.5 minutes ago, much less what my mother told me in an argument 30 years ago.
It's poetic verisimilitude.
It's poetic license, right. And not everything is permitted. We would agree to that. However, when someone picks up a memoir or a book labeled as such, the person expects there to be a certain level of truth, or else what's the point of it being a memoir to begin with? So what is that level? What's that acceptable level of truth? That question hasn't been answered. Maybe it can't be answered, but that's the key question.
The French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, you write that he believed that all memoirists, that is, up until Rousseau himself, were liars. And this is one guy's memoir in which you seem to entirely believe. He didn't sugarcoat, did he?
Well, he certainly didn't sugarcoat, and that's a little insider's hint to memoirists. If you want to be believed, make yourself look bad. that can cover a multitude of fabrications. He detailed his unseemly sexual habits. He made himself look like a small, petty person for making a servant girl take the rap for something he committed. Significantly, Rousseau read some portions of the book aloud while he was working on it and was met with shock and scandal.
Women who could be bought for money would lose, for me, all their charms. I even doubt whether it would be in me to make use of them. I only love those enjoyments which belong to no one but the first man who knows how to enjoy them.
In the end, the book was not published till after his death, probably fortunately for Rousseau.
You note that one of the most influential memoirs of all time, one that set the template for generations, was actually explicitly fiction. I will read the first sentence. I was born in the year 1632 in the city of York of a good family, though not of that country, my father being a foreigner of Bremen who settled first at Hull. He got a good estate by merchandise and leaving his trade, lived afterward at York, from whence he married my mother, whose relations were named Robinson, a very good family in that country, and from whom I was called Robinson Kreutznayer. But by the usual corruption of words in England, we now call ourselves and write our name Crusoe. And so my companions always called me.
Oh, I want to hear more. That is great. Daniel Defoe. Oh, boy, what a writer. Yeah, and Robinson Crusoe was in the form of an autobiography, totally made up out of whole cloth, though there was a real person that it was based on. But at this time in the 1700s, there was no labels. There was no nonfiction bestseller list. There was no memoir section of the store. It just came out as a book. And people honestly didn't know what to make of it. Some people were fooled and then got really mad when they found out that it was fiction.
But how did he influence the creation of true chronicles?
Well, that's an amazing thing. I mean, he wrote a series of books, Moll Flanders, Robinson Crusoe, and several others that were novels in the form of autobiography. And the success of these novels actually influenced people to write real autobiographies.
You know, Ben, there's one thing that comes through loud and clear in this very entertaining book of yours. No matter what stabs you make at even-handedness here and there, you really don't think much of the memoir. When you like one, you usually say that it transcends the genre. Why okay. Can't it be seen as a brilliant expression of the genre?
Wow, I didn't realize that. I believe you. I feel agnostic as to the genre. I really do. I don't think I like it or dislike it. In fact, on balance, I would say I'm on the plus side just because, you know, I teach writing and you know the biggest cliche of writing instruction.
Write what you know.
Exactly. And it's a cliche because it's true. People who write about what they know tend to write stronger, more compelling, more readable prose. And that's what a memoirist does. It's subject to abuse, self-indulgence, going on and on too long, making stuff up. But in the right hands, those ones that, as you say, I praise, it's really a pretty spiffy genre.
What's your favorite memoir?
Russell Baker's Growing Up, which came out before the memoir boom and maybe as such did not focus on abuse, trauma, etc., but rather on the singularity of his experience and the pleasures of good writing and observation.
What's a memoir that you hate?
I would say Running with Scissors by Augustine Burroughs.
And why is that?
As we said earlier, dialogue in a memoir is something that's expected, and a certain amount of it is poetic license. But the more you do it, the more you're just throwing in the reader's face the fact that this really isn't true in the full sense of the word true. Furthermore, in his book, the attitude towards the people that he writes about is very disdainful, dismissive, filled with cheap shots. I just didn't like the whole approach of the book.
"You infantile tyrant," my mother shouted from her position on the sofa, legs folded up beneath her. "You'd like nothing more than to see me slit my wrists."
You didn't like him.
Right. You respond to that book and you're responding to that writer. And it's really one and the same thing. A memoirist really puts himself or herself out there. And I do find that admirable.
Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ben Yagoda teaches journalism at the University of Delaware. His new book is Memoir, A History.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from James Hoffer, Dan Mazzi, and Julia Simon, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I am Brooke Gladstone as well.
I don't want your history.
All right, then, I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.